This is the NBC University Theater, bringing you a full-hour dramatization of the Jonathan Swift classic, Gulliver's Travels, starring Henry Hull as Lemuel Gulliver. This is a story written by a man who searched his fellow men and found nothing but greed and vice and evil. In the years since 1726, when the book appeared, men have read his satire and laughed. But through that laughter rings a bitter note of recognition, for we can see ourselves in the characters that people his pages. Here, then, is a picture of us all. Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift.
My name is Lemuel Gulliver, and this is the journal of my travels about the world. For 16 years, I sailed the seas first as surgeon and then as captain of my own vessel. And in that time, I have had adventures the like of which few men can dream. And I shall feel the stamp of it for all my days. It all began in the year 1699, when I accepted a berth aboard the vessel Antelope, bound for the South Seas. I shall not trouble you with the particulars of that voyage, but let it suffice to say that in our passage, we ran afoul of a tropic storm. The weather being very hazy, we had lookouts posted every masthead. Then suddenly, through the fog, a voice cut down from aloft.
Rig out to port! A rock! A rock a half cable's length!
Too late to save her! Stand by to launch the longboat!
Aye, sir! All hands to quarters! Jump there!
The rock! The rock! We're on it!
The good ship Antelope foundered almost immediately, and we were all consigned to the mercy of the waves. But there was no mercy in that madness. I grasped a floating timber and held on, tossed heavenward by the giant swells, and then dashed down into the roaring sea. What became of my companions, I cannot tell, but conclude that they were lost. When I finally struggled to shore, I was in so weak condition that I lay down on the sand and fell asleep. Some hours later, I was awakened by a noise like the humming of insects. A silken whispering like grass in the wind. I tried to rise, only to find my arms and legs fastened securely to the ground, and the very strands of my hair pegged out in the same manner. But suddenly, I heard a buzzing near my head, a strange, high-pitched, fluttering sound. I could not move my head, but as I listened to this tiny buzz, I thought... I thought the sun and wave had unhinged my senses. For as I listened closer, more intently...
Red mountain.
It was true.
Red mountain.
There were words. The little insect humming was really words. I wrenched my head free and peered down at my chest and saw him.
Red mountain. Listen, Red mountain.
It was a man. A human creature not 6 inches high, advancing gently forward upon my breast, and following him a company of 50 of the same kind, armed with bow and arrow.
Captain, make sure of the ropes. The man mountain may escape. Company forward.
Avast there, you rascals. Off me. Loose me.
Steady, men. The man mountain is securely tied.
Let me get...
Captain, take 2 men and explore yon cavern in his head.
Enough. Stay off me. Get out of my nose. Get out of my... That sneeze sent you sailing. Now loose me. Do you hear? Untie me.
Hear me, Man Mountain.
What? Still here? He's a strange little creature. Not 6 inches high, yet as perfectly formed as any man.
Hear me, Man Mountain. I am Rekkersil, the King's Minister of Private Affairs. I shall try to help you.
Aye, little man. Help me first by unloosening my hair. It pulls most painfully.
First you must see the king.
Well, if you'll not unloose me, then you must feed me. I am fair faint with hunger.
But that is attended to. Yonder on the plain a herd of cattle approaches, and I've sent to the king's cellar for several hogsheads of wine. Now, be content, Man Mountain, and remember, Rekkersil is your friend.
And so I came to the land of Lilliput. I was at first strongly tempted to break my bonds and seize up a handful of these tiny men who had dealt so audaciously with my person and dice them to the ground. But as I ate, my anger abated. In Lilliput, as in my own island, the state of a man's stomach is likely to govern his emotions. I topped off my meal with a hogshead of good wine, and then I fell asleep.
Mountain. Wake up. Soldiers, shoot an arrow at him.
Pow! Ouch! Oh, what
is it? Where am I?
You are in an ancient temple. It was the only building large enough for you. It took 1,500 horses to draw you here.
Why, what's that?
Oh, the Emperor. Oh, down on your knees, Man Mountain. Quickly. It is the Emperor.
A mighty procession turned in the temple gate. Spearmen, bowmen, all no higher than my middle finger. And then, magnificent upon a war horse, 4 inches high...
His Imperial Majesty, Grabasto Mamaran, most mighty Emperor of Lilliput, delight and terror of the universe, monarch of all monarchs, at whose nod the princes of the earth shake their knees.
Hear me, Man Mountain.
Your most humble servant, Your Majesty.
Oh there. Oh, whoops.
Oh, perhaps I upset your charger, Your Majesty. Shall I lift you up to my ear so that we may converse?
Very well, Man Mountain.
Right, up you come, then.
Very well, then. Hear me, Man Mountain. In the name of the Empire, I welcome you to Lilliput. You are to be protected from harm, providing you shall subscribe to certain articles under the Great Seal.
I have no choice, Your Majesty. In the presence of royalty, I am overcome with awe.
Of course. Now, Man Mountain, you will please stand with your legs planted wide.
Mm-hmm, yes, like this, Your Majesty.
Precisely. My father built an arch of triumph 70 grumbuffs tall. But never in the history of Lilliput has there been a colossus such as you.
I am happy to please Your Majesty.
And now my army shall parade beneath your arched legs. And I will go down in Lilliputian history. General, start the parade.
And so, for the horses, 16 abreast, flags flying and bands blaring, the mighty army of Lilliput marched between my feet in the bravest military display ever seen on the island empire. Then the emperor caused the chain to be struck off my ankle, and I was set at liberty. And as a special mark of esteem, I was invited to the most solemn of all court proceedings. With Rekkersil, the minister, perched on my shoulder, I sat on the ground and watched the dignified procedures.
Watch carefully, Man Mountain. You are to witness the annual performance of the king's ministers. See, all is ready.
Oh, what is that thread stretched tight between those tiny poles?
The royal tightrope. It stands 10 glumguffs above the ground of fearsome height. Now watch, the first royal minister is climbing up onto the rope. Somersaults, jumps, leaps, sand on his head.
Amazing, amazing. Such skillful tumbling I've never seen in England. Tell me, how do they acquire such skill?
Oh, they're trained from their youth.
You mean as acrobats? The king's ministers?
Why, yes. In Lilliput, when a political office is vacant, the emperor holds a contest, and whoever jumps the highest and does the most difficult feats on the tight rope wins the office.
How remarkable.
That's Flimnap on the rope now, candidate for office of royal treasurer.
He's superb. Oh, what grace, what agility.
Oh, yes. All the king's ministers are notoriously agile.
But is this rope dancing really a true test of a man's qualifications for public office?
Perhaps you've thought of a better test in your country?
No. No, on second thought, I fancied not. The ministers of my country must also be expert in dancing the tightrope and cutting agile capers. Perhaps it is more logical to have them tested on a real tightrope. When an English minister falls, he retires wealthy. When a Lilliputian falls from the tightrope, he breaks his neck. I now began to enjoy my stay among the Lilliputians. Never had I beheld a more entertaining prospect. The country round about was a continual flower garden. The towns, like the painted scenes of a city in the theater. Surely, thought I, in this setting of ideal loveliness, these tiny, doll-like people must have attained a state of happiness and perfection that we larger mortals only dream of. But when I had been among the Lilliputians for only a month, my good friend Redwistle visited me incognito and climbed upon my shoulder to whisper in my ear. Oh, come, speak louder, Redwistle, louder. I can't hear you.
Must be whispered, Man Mountain. It would never do to let the people know what is going on.
Well, what is going on?
We labor under two mighty evils here in Lilliput. The first, a bitter political struggle within our borders.
A political struggle here, too?
For about 70 moons past, there have been two struggling parties among us, the Tramixans and the Slamixans.
Well, how do these parties differ politically?
Oh, most profoundly. One party adheres to the wearing of high heel shoes.
Yes.
The other favors low heel.
Ah, I see. High heels and low heels.
Now, His Majesty has been inclined to support the position of lesser heels in his administration. We low heelers are in the minority, but we have the power. The animosity runs so high that the parties will neither eat nor drink with each other.
Is there no hope of a compromise?
Neither party will yield a fraction. Even the king's son is involved in the conflict.
And how does the prince stand?
He wobbles. On one foot, he wears a high-heeled shoe. On the other, a low. Because of this circumstance, he wobbles from left to right.
Well, he sounds like a young man, most unusually endowed for political leadership.
Oh, yes. But alas, 'tis his father, not he, that is on the throne. The country is divided, and to make matters worse, we are at this moment threatened with an invasion from the island of Blefuscu.
An invasion?
Oh, yes. We've been engaged in war with Blefuscu for 36 moons. 'Tis a long and bloody struggle.
But why? What started your war with Blefuscu? Do you recall?
It was a most grievous religious schism. It started with an egg.
An egg?
You see, it is agreed that the primitive and natural way of cracking an egg is upon the larger end.
Well, of course, yes.
And the present emperor's great-grandfather, however, chanced to cut his hand while opening an egg at the big end. So he issued an edict commanding all of his subjects to break the smaller end of their egg.
Ah, yes, and this caused unrest.
Our people so resented this edict that there have been 6 rebellious uprisings, wherein one emperor has lost his life and another his crown.
But how does this edict of the egg involve you with Blefuscu?
The monarchs of Blefuscu keep fomenting the big Indian heresy. They send spies among us, raising civil strife, and so the war has raged.
But this is serious. Tell me, Redwistle, is there nothing I can do?
That is why I am here. His Majesty is placing all his hopes in your strength, Man Mountain.
I am greatly flattered. Present my humble duty to His Majesty and let him know that I stand ready with my life to defend his state against invaders.
His Majesty, the Emperor of Lilliput.
Hear me, Man Mountain.
Your humble servant, Your Majesty.
My spies have informed me that the fleet of Lepus Union warships waits only the turn of the tide to sail upon us. Man Mountain, you are commanded to exercise your valor and strength to prevent this invasion.
Your Majesty, I am at your service. Your puissance has overwhelmed me. Shall I set you back down on the ground? I'm sure you must be uncomfortable perched on my finger thus.
Very well, Man Mountain. But carry out my command at once. At once.
Hold tight, Red Whistle, hold tight. The water's almost up to my shoulders.
Don't slip, Man Mountain. There, that's the main port of Blefuscu ahead.
Yeah, there's the fleet, all right. Men of war no bigger than toys.
Seen you, Man Mountain. Oh, look out. They're firing arrows at you.
Get behind that collar, Red Whistle. Here we are in the middle of the fleet. We collect the anchor cables and we pull them up. Now we just pull them away.
Oh, Man Mountain. The whole Lepistudian fleet. You're stealing it away. The war is won. Lilliput is triumphant.
I was a hero, the man of the hour. The crowd shouted my name, and the emperor caused himself to be lifted by engines and pulleys to the height of my forehead, where he kissed my brow after the fashion of the land. Through the streets of the capital, the populace made merry, dancing and singing long into the night. I made merry with more hogs of wine than I chose to count. But, alas, I was to learn how fickle is the public mind.
Man Mountain.
Who is it? Wait till I get my spectacles.
Sorry, Rickerson.
Well, what brings you out in the morning, my friend? Wait till I bend down. Now, what is it?
An affair of state.
I thought everything was settled by now. The ambassadors arrived from Blefuscu to make peace, did they not?
Let me come closer, Man Mountain. Huh? I must speak for your ear alone. Set down your fingers.
Very well, let's better hear. Now, up you come.
Now then, Man Mountain, I've come under express order from His Majesty.
Well, now, what does he want of me now?
He commands you to go at once to Blefuscu to seize the Blefuscudian king and all his royal army and to bring them back to Lilliput for public execution.
But zounds, and he can't be serious. You're no longer in any danger from Blefuscu. Their fleet is destroyed. Now, why not try to live in peace?
Oh, my friend, such is not the habit of princes. His Majesty is determined to rule Blefuscu. And he has other orders for you.
What other orders?
He has in his possession a list of all people in this kingdom known to be big Endians. He wishes you to seize them and...
But this religiousism is none of my affair.
Nevertheless, it is His Majesty's intention to stamp out the entire race of big Endians. All eggs in Lilliput will be broken at the small end.
And if they refuse...
They will be exterminated.
I understand. Now, listen carefully, Red Whistle. You may return to His Majesty and say to him that I refuse to comply with his orders. You may say to him that I shall never be the instrument for bringing any race of people to death or enslavement. I waited. All day the streets were deathly quiet. From my window I observed a continual stream of ministers with portfolios flowing toward the palace. I waited and I pondered. I saw old Admiral Bolgolam and Limtok, the general of the armies, hurry away to give orders. When night fell, I became more and more uneasy. Then, in the palace courtyard, by the flaring light of torches, a grim procession formed.
Listen, loyal citizens of Lilliput! Hear the words of the Emperor! Articles of impeachment against Lemuel Gulliver, the Man Mountain, for treason, sedition, lewd majesty, and other capital crimes. Article 1, whereas...
Well, Red Rizzle, I gather you gave the Emperor my message.
Man Mountain, you are in grave danger. You must leave Lilliput at once.
But why, how so?
As you can tell, His Majesty is most angry. The King's ministers have voted for your death.
My death?
Yes. However, His Majesty has ruled against that.
Well, thank heaven.
It was a fierce debate.
Praise heaven. Then they decided against killing me?
Oh, yes. It is his intention instead to blind you.
Blind me? But why? Why, Red Rizzle? Tell me, why should he do this monstrous thing to me?
Oh, it was a masterstroke of cleverness. Another monarch might have agreed to your execution, but not he. Dead, you would be of no service to him.
I see. It is. He feels the loss of my sight won't diminish my strength.
Exactly. You will still be of service. In fact, greater service, for blind, you cannot be tempted to rebellion.
What diabolical reason. What a low, contemptible race is this treacherous tribe of princes. In Europe or in Lilliput, there is no gratitude under a crown.
Oh, it would seem so.
Was there no voice raised in protest for this monstrous plan?
One voice. I am no longer a member of His Majesty's cabinet.
You? Oh, forgive me the things I said, Red Rizzle. My friend.
I could not bear to think of you reduced to such ignominy, Man Mountain. At any moment, I expect to be accused of the Bigendian heresy. Thus, His Majesty treats revolted ministers. I come to warn you to make your escape. The company to shoot out your eyes is on its way.
You must have come at great risk.
Only my life.
I am deeply grateful to you. But then you must come with me. Now, hold tight, friend Red Rizzle. We must wade across the channel to both rescue and safety.
Hurry, Man Mountain. Hurry.
These blasted waves. Still there, Red Rizzle?
Yes. Fast to your collar. Look, Man Mountain. Look into the sea. A monster object floating in.
Well, what? No. Oh, thank heaven. No, it can't be.
What, Man Mountain?
It is. It is the longboat. The longboat from my ship. Belly up, but floating.
A boat as big as you. Amazing.
A firm hold, Red Rizzle. A firm hold. I must set you ashore on Blefuscu and swim out to the longboat before it clears the island. It is my escape, Red Rizzle. My clear way. Home to England. Truly, Providence watches over shipwrecked mariners. For it was indeed the badly battered shell of a ship's longboat that I dragged ashore on Blefuscu. I set sail on the 24th of September, 1701, at 6 in the morning, and within a week, I descried a sail. The vessel was an English merchantman returning from Japan. The captain was very kind, although he treated me as though I were raving when I told my story. But it was not long before I landed in England and hurried to Redriff and to Mary, my wife. I stayed but 2 months with my wife and family, for off I must go on another voyage. So, with tears on both sides, I went on board the brig Adventure, bound for Surat. But my account of this voyage must be referred to the second part of my travels,
For thus endeth the first part of the travels of Lemuel Gulliver.
From Hollywood, the NBC University Theater is bringing you Henry Hull in a radio play based on Jonathan Swift's brilliant satire, Gulliver's Travels, the first in a new series of dramatizations of classics in the world of Anglo-American literature. If you are interested in supplementing your enjoyment of these productions with home study under college supervision, be sure to listen to the announcement to be made at the close of our program. Now, our intermission commentator on Gulliver's Travels, Mr. Mark Van Doren, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and professor of English at Columbia University. We present Mr. Van Doren speaking to you from New York.
Gulliver's Travels was intended by its author, Jonathan Swift, to vex the world rather than divert it. But when he published the book in 1726... he diverted more readers than he vexed. And it still is true that the human world refuses to recognize itself in the terrible story Swift told. Gulliver's Travels has remained a classic for children and men. The imagination required to produce it has triumphed over the misanthropy that called it forth. And the reason may be found in something its author once said: "I have ever hated all nations, professions, and communities. All my love is towards individuals. But principally I hate and detest that animal called man, although I heartily love John, Peter, Thomas, and so forth." He hated the race, but he loved its members. The great satirist was a great friend. He could not foresee that this would be felt by his readers, every one of whom has considered himself Swift's friend, listening to him in fascination while he spends his fury on the rest of the race. Yet no such fury has ever existed in another man, and no such art to express it. Even the happiest reader of Gulliver's Travels must admit that its author has laid traps for humanity which neither imagination nor reason can escape. In each of the four parts, he maneuvers us into an impossible position. The four positions, in fact, are one. Gulliver, who stands for us, believes that what he sees is proof of man's superiority, but discovers, or we discover for him, that the opposite is the case. The people of Lilliput must be as petty in their minds as they are in their bodies, but their minds turned out to be exactly like ours. The Brobdingnagians suppose our midget bodies to contain midget souls. When Gulliver cites human history as evidence to the contrary, the king of the giants is merely confirmed in his disgust. The pedants of Laputa, so fantastically lacking in common sense, are but copies of our own scientists, mathematicians, and philosophers. The perfect horse people of the fourth part, the beautiful Houyhnhnms, mistake Gulliver for a filthy Yahoo because he goes on two legs. "But listen," he says, "while I tell you what we are like inside." They are only sickened by the exposure. Gulliver's Travels is one of the most charming books in the world. But let us not deceive ourselves. It is unanswerable.
Thank you, Mr. Van Doren. Our dramatization of Gulliver's Travels with Henry Hull in the title role continues from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
You will be set adrift without water. You will not be so fierce with the sun beating down on you and your insolent tongue black and cracking with thirst. Cast him adrift!
For 2 days I drifted in the sea, suffering much from thirst and exposure. When, at length, I was cast ashore on a rocky island, there I spent the night, and in the morning I commenced to search for food. Presently, I noticed that a dark cloud had come between me and the sun, and I was astounded to see that this cloud was in reality a vast mountain sailing through the air, giving off a loud humming. This island hovered over me at the height of about 200 feet. And presently, a chair was let down on ropes and pulleys. And seating myself in it, I was drawn rapidly upward. ¶¶
welcome. Welcome, stranger, to the flying island of Laputa. By your clothing and the regular geometrical pattern of your hat, I assume you to be a creature of intellectual and philosophical attainment. Therefore, welcome.
But, sir, where am I? How does this island float so?
This is the capital of the kingdom, Laputa. Our island hovers through the agency of a giant lodestone. Thus, our glorious philosopher king controls his dominion.
How so?
If any town below should enter in a rebellion, his majesty has merely to hover above it. The unruly subjects below are deprived of sun and rain, and presently they must sicken and die. Or we pelt them with great stones, and then they must creep into cellars and caves to live.
Truly a monstrous engine.
Come along now, stranger, to my home. As we go, I shall ask you diverting questions of mathematical and philosophical import.
I am most grateful, sir.
Permit me, stranger. This is the king's philosopher, Daldando.
Tell me, stranger, how would you square a circle?
Well, I'm afraid that
how would you exactly trisect an angle?
Well, that would require a logarithmic scale.
No, it is a prime of the inverse of the root.
Gentlemen, I insisted
it's a dividend of the summation of the prime.
Gentlemen, please, I beg of you, you are walking in a puddle.
What? Oh, yes. No matter.
But your feet are wet.
You see, stranger, we Laputans consider philosophic and intellectual exercise the prime pleasure. We cannot be bothered with mere reality. Puddles.
Oh, I see.
But look out! That building is falling!
Another one.
That suggests an interesting philosophical analog.
No, sir. But no wonder it collapsed. Look at those buildings. Not a right angle among them. Everything's tied at irregular angles.
A right angle is such a simple concept. Remember, stranger, we of Laputa are men of intellect.
And so they were, men of intellect. They are expert in the theoretical sciences, mathematics, music, astronomy, but for practical applications, they have only contempt. Their nobles become so lost in thought that a strange custom prevails among them. With us, as we walked, was a servant armed with an inflated bladder on a stick. With this, he kept the conversation going in this wise.
The concept of the absolute of good is mathematically demonstrable, is it not, Daldando?
The servant flapped his weapon against the ear of Daldando to signify he was to listen.
Eh? Hmm? What?
Then he flapped his flapper against the philosopher's mouth to signify...
Fellow sympathy.
Sir.
Oh. Yes, quite so. Quite so.
You see, these sages, when immersed in speculation, and the servant with the flapper is necessary to recall this to them. Occasionally, the servant flaps his master upon his eyes to remind him to look. For otherwise, these great scientists would run into every post along the way and trip over every bucket. At this point, a lass of more than extraordinary charm chanced by, and I turned to gaze after her.
Come, stranger, what are you staring at?
Yonder lass? Hang it, old man, she's uncommonly well set up.
You think so? A servant, my spectacles. Yes. Her nose appears to be a perfect isosceles triangle.
A triangle?
I detect no imperfection in the ellipses of her eyes.
However, her trunk, I'm afraid, departs notably from the shape of the perfect trapezoid.
Ah, yes. There are definite, irregular, obloid characteristics.
And her calves conform to no geometric figure with which I am familiar. Now, friend, were we not talking of the diminished seventh harmonic in the tonic scale?
In the months I spent on the flying island of Laputa, I was constantly amazed that more people did not tumble over the edge. For these great thinkers are so enthralled in cerebral speculation that they never watch ahead as they walk. However, I discovered that the greatest thinkers of all were shut away in an institution called the Grand Academy of Projectors. And thither I turned my steps to gain knowledge and understanding.
Your pass. Present your pass.
Oh, where do I find the philosophers at work?
331 paces down that corridor. Apply at the window for a map, a chronometer, pedometer, and sextant. This is our first project, the Institute for Human Betterment. We're at present engaged in the project to transform ice into gunpowder.
Ice into gunpowder. Amazing. But why?
We haven't discovered the benefits yet, but it will inevitably turn up. Oh, on your right, we're building the model of a process for beginning all buildings at the top and working down.
But to what purpose?
Human betterment, of course.
Oh, yes.
The workers, having completed the top floor, are shielded from the sun and rain while completing the remainder.
But isn't this method of building a little, hazardous?
Well, we have had trouble with the top floor coming down on the workers' heads. But take this model. Look at it. Steady as the earth itself. Don't be alarmed. We'll use this model anyway. And our medical staff shall work out a new method of curing cracked skulls. Well, friend Gulliver, what do you think about civilization of science and intellect?
I'm impressed, noble lord, but I am puzzled.
How so, Gulliver?
Well, I admit that I'm a simple man, a plain sea captain. I don't know the theory of advanced mathematics and harmony.
Yes?
But I have been forced to the conclusion that in spite of all your theoretical discussions of human betterment, your people still live in misery. Their houses are in ruins. They are without food and clothing in their faces. I see naught but despair.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, our interest does not lie in the gross, vulgar handicrafts and arts. Our best philosophers tell us that when the land is ruled by the greatest, deepest, most abstract thinkers, misery is bound to perish. This can be mathematically proven. And you can't argue with mathematics.
My restless nature did not allow me to remain longer among the Laputans. I came away before I could witness the triumph of pure reason and abstract philosophy over human misery. I shipped aboard a small trading vessel to Japan, where I caught an East Indiaman returning to England, Redriff and my beloved wife, Mary. The seafarer on land is a sorry creature, straining at every passing wind and longing for the feel of the heaving deck beneath his feet. So it was not 5 months later that I shipped out for what was to be my last voyage, and to that part of the world which is most likely to tax my listeners' credulity. It happened that in a tropic storm I was washed overboard by a prodigious wave and carried by the waves to the shore of a tropic island that lay to the west. In search of water, I came across the tracks of what seemed to be barefoot savages, mingled with the tracks of horses. Then suddenly I was attacked. My attackers' heads and breasts were covered with thick hair. They had beards like goats and a long ridge of hair down their backs. They walked on two legs and bounded about most agilely. Altogether, they were the most unpleasant, foul-smelling, evil-visaged animals I have ever encountered.
Off me! Off me, filthy beast! Away! Away!
The devil. A horse. A horse. And he scared them off. Here. Here's a fine fellow. Come, boy. Come. Come, fellow. Here. Ah, there. There's a fine horse.
Whom have we here? Who are you, strange Yahoo?
What? What is this?
It is the horse. He speaks.
An answer, Yahoo.
I am a shipwrecked sailor, sir.
I know not those words. You're a strange Yahoo indeed. Your body is covered, and you speak intelligently? That is indeed a wonder.
I, sir, am not a Yahoo. I don't even know what that is.
Those beasts that attacked you, the filthy creatures that walk on two legs, they are Yahoo.
But my name is Lemuel Gulliver. I'm a man, sir, a man.
You're a Yahoo. And yet I've not seen one like you before. Come. Come along with me.
This is impossible. This is... You're a horse.
I'm a Wynnum. This is Wynnumland. Come now, Yahoo. Faster.
I'm sorry. I can't. Well, now, perhaps if I could ride you...
What?
If I might mount your back, I...
Strange creature. In Wynnumland, the Yahoos are the beasts of burden, and we the masters.
Horses? Masters over men? How horrible.
Horrible, strange Yahoo? Why so? I know the Yahoos well. I own a large herd of them. They are the most odious of all animals.
But I'm not speaking of these foul, degraded beasts. I speak of men in Europe. They keep the horses as beasts of burden.
You speak a thing that is not so.
You mean I lie?
We have no such word in our language. No Wynnum would say what is not so. Well, then what would be the purpose of talking? No. Yahoos can never rule. They are too vicious, foul, and evil-minded.
My master, the Wynnum, a beautiful black stallion, took me to his home. It was a rough building, for the Wynnums know not the use of iron. There his family greeted me. His wife, a sorrel mare of gentle and dignified feature, showed me to my stall.
Here, strange Yahoo, this is your stall. Endeavor to keep it clean.
Thank you, mistress.
It may be lonely for you away from the herd.
Herd? Of Yahoos? Oh, no, mistress, no. Pray, do not think of me as one of that foul race.
You are different. Cleaner and more gentle.
Where did they come from, mistress? Have you always known the Yahoos?
Why, some say they sprung to life from slime, much warmed by the sun. For only so could one account for the degraded disposition and habits of this two-legged race.
But in my land there are men also.
That is the other story Wynnums tell. That long years ago, two Yahoos swam ashore from across the sea, and their offspring were tamed, as much as such a vicious animal can be.
My master continually addressed me as a Yahoo, and when I begged him to desist, he caused a full-grown male Yahoo to be driven into the courtyard, and he ordered me to strip to the waist. Then my master walked slowly round the pair of us.
You are the same race, strange Yahoo. See? The same limbs, eyes, mouth, body. Drive this beast back to his kennel. Well, strange Yahoo, can you still deny your race?
But, master, I tell you I have nothing in common with these creatures. I am a man, sir. An Englishman.
An Englishman? Tell me of this country where the Yahoos rule.
I... You see now, how can I tell you of the benefits of civilization? Well, we have magnificent castles, gorgeous clothing, the noblest, most costly meats and drinks. Our ships go to the ends of the earth to bring these luxuries back for the wealthy.
Wealthy? What is wealthy?
Wealthy. Well, that means a man who can command all these luxuries and leave them to his children.
These good things of your civilization, they are not given to all?
Oh, no, by all means, no.
Then not every Yahoo enjoys them.
Not one in a thousand. The bulk of our people, well, they simply labor for small wages. They must live in hovels and squalor and spend their lives in their own filth.
Yes, strange one. That is the way of Yahoos. A Yahoo is an odious, vicious beast around the world.
During the days I stayed with the Winnims, I could never make my master grasp the difference between the men of Europe and his own bestial herd of Yahoos. Again and again he pressed me to explain the wars of my native country. I told him that sometimes one prince does quarrel with another for fear that the other should quarrel with him. Sometimes a war is entered on because the enemy is too strong, and sometimes because he is too weak. My master reported our conversation to the Parliament of Winnims, and they did memorialize him to send me away.
Nay, strange Yahoo, I shall keep you with me a while longer.
But, master, if the Parliament has ordered
we
you...
We know not ordered in this land, Yahoo. The decision of the Parliament is for the good of the nation, and no other force is needed. Is it different in your land, Yahoo?
Indeed. In Europe, there is a race of men who live by enforcing the rule of the government upon the people.
How else do Yahoos live in your land, strange one?
Well, there are the recognized professions, of course, like doctoring.
Doctoring? Another strange word.
You see, it is a part of our civilization that we eat when we are not hungry, drink without provocation of thirst, sit whole nights imbibing strong liquors.
Most extraordinary.
All of which, of course, disposes us to sloth, inflames our bodies, and prevents digestion.
Incredible.
Oh, no. It works out very well. If civilized man conducted himself sensibly, then there would be no work for our doctors. And how, then, would they live?
Peace, Yahoo. Peace. Each tale you tell me of this vicious kennel of savage Europe, this wallow of Yahoo vice, convinces me there is no hope for your pitiable two-legged race.
Master, you are displeased with me.
For the Yahoos in my field, the wild naked breed, I've always felt a kind of pity.
Pity? For those gross brutes?
For their ignorance, strange one. But the Yahoos of your country, your England, they pretend to reason.
Indeed we do.
Reason, Yahoo? Nay. You are possessed only of some quality fitted to increase your natural vices. Just as the reflection from a troubled stream returns the image of an ill-shapen body, not only larger, but more distorted.
No, Master, you're unfair.
No, Yahoo. For all your talk of civilization, you have never mentioned the words that we Winnims prize most deeply. Peace, justice, and happiness.
Peace, justice, happiness. I must, we men, nay, we Yahoos of Europe, know nothing of these. But in time, dwelling amongst the Winnims, I was to learn something of peace and happiness. Here in this land was neither backbiter, pickpocket, buffoon, politician, bawd, procurer. Here was no dungeon or gibbet, whipping post or pillory, no pride, vanity, or affectation, no bullies, drunkards, scoundrels, lords, fiddlers, judges, no ranting or expensive wives. In short, no vice, no injustice, only peace.
You have lived with us many moons now, Yahoo.
And happy, Master. Happier than ever I have been.
I have just come from the Parliament of the Winnims.
No, Master, no. Don't tell me the decision. I know now that you Winnims alone, of all the creatures on this earth, have mastered the art of living.
You do us honor, Yahoo.
You must show the race of Yahoos, my fellows. We must live as you do.
Brute beasts live with reason. Two-legged, odious savages learn the rule of nature.
I know, but hear me, Master. Far from the east has come a certain powder which will fly up into the air with a noise greater than thunder. Gunpowder.
But Might that not prove destructive?
Exactly. It will tear through armor, topple houses and battlements, lay waste cities, dash out the brains of all who are near.
Stop! Stop, Yahoo! Tell me no more!
Hear me out, Master. Hear me out. I know the ingredients of this powder. I understand the compounding of it. I could teach it to you.
To me? What would I want with such dreadful knowledge?
With sufficient quantities of this powder, your people, Winims, horses, could teach the world of Yahoos the secret of a just life.
Silence, Yahoo. I would rather lose my life 1,000 times over than be privy to your dreadful secret.
Master, I meant no harm.
Yahoo, I shrink from you in disgust and fear. Your race is corrupt, debased. You will leave this land.
No, no, no. Mercy, Master, mercy.
You will leave this land and return to that race of evil creatures, the Yahoos that you call men.
I was allowed the space of 2 months to build a boat, and no Winner was suffered to address me in any way. My heart was heavier than I had ever known it, and I was filled with a great shame and disgust for my own kind. Then, on the morning of my departure, my master and mistress came to the shore to see me leave.
We have come to bid you goodbye, strange Yahoo.
And safe voyage.
Master, mistress.
You are but a Yahoo. You know no better. We pity you.
But is there no hope for our race? Are we Yahoos to live forever in savagery and vice?
This powder you speak of may be your salvation, strange one. There is but one end for you. Yahoo against Yahoo, you will destroy yourself.
Master, is that the only end?
Away, strange one. Into the sea.
Goodbye, my master. My mistress. Goodbye.
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 Goodbye. Take care, gentle Yahoo. Goodbye.
I sailed in my makeshift craft, I know not where, until at length I was picked up by a Spanish merchantman captained by Pedro de Mendez, a man of great patience and great understanding. For in the condition he found me, I was in need of both.
Here, hold him. Hold him tight.
Hands off. Hands off. Hands off. Hands off, foul, stinking Yahoos. Come, beast.
Come, Senor Gulliver. Peace. Peace. You are rescued now. You are among civilized men.
Civilized? Why, say you, man, civilized. You are all Yahoos. Filthy, crawling, unreasoned beasts. Yahoos. Yahoos all.
I do not know this word, Senor Gulliver. Yahoos.
Let me be. Let me be, I tell you. Do you think I wish to return to those swamps of Yahoo cities? Those kennels piled high with Yahoo dirt and filth? Let me go. Let me go. Sooner I'd cast myself into the sea.
Yes, yes, of course, Senor Gulliver, of course. Hold him tighter, man, el pobrecito loco. He is crazy.
Yahoos! Yahoos!
Hold him!
Yahoos!
Yahoos, indeed. Peace, Senor Gulliver. At last you are among men.
And so, I am back in England, Yahoo Land. I retired to my farm at Redriff, where I hope to spend my declining years in solitude. For the sight, the smell of the Yahoos of the land of my birth has filled me with a loathing and revulsion I cannot disguise. I see my own race as petty, wild, treacherous Yahoos, and I would not traffic with them. Perhaps I may teach the lessons I learned from my master, the Winim, but knowing the nature of my fellow Yahoos, I can but hope for success. And as for this, the journal of my travels, read it, my fellows, read it well. Some will pass it by as a fantasy of travel, a storybook for the idle. But for others, it will be as it is for me, the plain, unvarnished truth. And thus endeth the travels of Lemuel Gulliver.
And so the curtain falls on the NBC University Theater production of Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift, starring Henry Hull in the title role. Next week, with the dramatization of Tom Jones, the NBC University of the Air officially opens a new semester in which we will cover the classics of Anglo-American literature from the time of Henry Fielding down to that of Henry James. If you wish, you may learn more about these authors and their works by enrolling in the college-supervised courses now being offered in connection with the NBC University of the Air, both the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma and Washington State College in the West. Have now completed their plans for offering such a course in the coming months, thus joining the University of Louisville, whose established home study plan is already serving listeners in another area of the nation. For information, then, as to how you may enhance your knowledge through these courses, write to the NBC University of the Air, in care of either the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky, Washington State College, Pullman, Washington, or the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Today's production of Gulliver's Travels was written by Frank and Virginia Wells. Our intermission commentator was Mr. Mark Van Doren, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and professor of English at Columbia University. And our star in the role of Lemuel Gulliver was Mr. Henry Hull, whose latest picture, Colorado Bound, is about to be released by Warner Brothers. Our cast included George Peroni as the Emperor of the Kingdom of Lilliput, Hugh Thomas, who was the King's Minister of Private Affairs, Parley Bear as the learned Laputan, Larry Dobkin, his associate, the philosopher to the King of Laputa, Barry Drew as the gatekeeper, Donald Morrison was the wise and tolerant Wynnum, Ida Reese Marin, his wife, the mayor, Earl Keane was heard in the various animal sounds. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The director of the University Theater is Andrew C. Love. Original music for Gulliver's Travels was conducted by Dr. Albert Harris. Next week at this time, the NBC University Theater will bring you its dramatization of the Henry Fielding novel, Tom Jones. This program came to you from Hollywood. A wonderful motion picture and now a hilarious radio play. We mean, of course, Hired Wife, starring Rosalind Russell. It's tonight's presentation on the NBC Theater. Be sure to hear Hired Wife with Rosalind Russell on NBC, immediately following Fred Allen on most of these NBC stations. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.